You're listening to Marketplace Weekend, where the economy meets real life. I'm Adrienne Hill in for Lizzie O'Leary. Shine up your apples, sharpen your pencils. It's back to school time. Around the country, schools have opened their doors or are just about to. I'm Adrienne Hill in for Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy meets real life. This week, we're talking about education. We start our show today with literacy, the ability to read and write, which is a skill most everybody needs to take part in our economy. In Michigan, there's a lawsuit that claims literacy as a constitutional right under the 14th Amendment, a right that students and families in Detroit say the state-run schools failed to meet. They're suing with the help of the pro bono law firm Public Counsel. On Thursday, the state argued a motion to dismiss the case, claiming there's no fundamental right to literacy and saying the schools aren't the only ones to blame. Lizzie visited Detroit and brings us this story.
It's hot and sticky in Detroit, and Jamarie Hall is hungry. He's 17, tall, absolute megawatt smile, and we're heading out for a bite to eat after his summer job at Wayne State University, boarding up abandoned houses.
It makes you feel like you're making a difference in people's everyday lives. It makes people feel safer walking to school or walking to work or something like that.
At Grandy's Coney Island, a local fast food joint, he goes for the total teenage boy order.
Yeah, so I'll probably just get the bacon cheeseburger with the fries and pop.
The food gets packed up, and we find a mostly intact picnic table to sit at. It's in a little park across the street from Hall's house in a neighborhood between 7 and 8 mile roads. He just graduated from Osborne Evergreen Academy of Design and Alternative Energy. It's one of the schools accused of failing to provide students with access to literacy.
There's been teachers that walked out of the classes saying they can't deal with it because it's hot in the classes. Boiler pipes are broken, so there might be steam coming out the heat or something like that. And then when it's cold outside, it's super cold in the building, so people might have on coats and things like that. Then there's might be rodents or anything in the class.
Plus endless substitute teachers and textbooks older than he is that he wasn't allowed to take home.
I just feel like I've been cheated. Like out of my last 4 years of high school, I feel like I've been cheated. Like why shouldn't I be able to when there's other students out here that can? Like it shouldn't be like that.
Why do you think it is?
Because of the community that we live in, where we were born, where we happen to live. Maybe because of our skin color.
Detroit's school system is complicated. Since 1999, the city's schools have been in and out of some form of state control. This fall, Detroit's new school board takes over. Detroit's test scores are consistently some of the lowest in the country. On average, 7% of eighth graders are proficient in reading. Part of what makes this case so important is the state of Michigan's argument. In the motion to dismiss the case, state lawyers argue that the obstacles kids in Detroit face, poverty, lack of parental involvement, domestic violence, and trauma, make it too hard to trace illiteracy to failing public schools. We reached out to the state attorney general's office, and they declined to comment because the litigation is ongoing.
They're saying they can't educate people because there's a poverty issue. But for me, they're saying you must negate poverty and educate anyway.
That's Shallon Miller. She teaches at Cody Medicine and Community Health Academy, one of the plaintiff schools. We dropped by Miller's house on the west side of Detroit. She was grilling jerk chicken in the backyard for a late lunch. And at Cody, Miller wears a lot of hats.
Not only am I a resource teacher at my high school, I'm the testing coordinator, I'm the union rep, I'm the senior prom advisor. So I have a home.
These aren't just issues at Cody. As of this spring, there were 263 teacher vacancies at Detroit Public Schools.
When you say uncertified teachers can teach in the city but nowhere else, what kind of policy is that? So for your children, certified teachers. For city children, black and brown children, placeholders.
All of this has largely been in the state's hands for more than 15 years. I mentioned earlier, that's changing. A city school board regains control of the public schools starting this fall.
We're doing everything that we can to remediate some of the adverse effects of decades of educational inequity.
That's Ellie Savitt, a senior advisor to Detroit's mayor, Mike Duggan.
We need to have a school system that's training Detroiters to get those jobs without the bridge programs that we're providing, to be college ready.
He wrote a brief in support of the plaintiff's case.
Full economic revitalization is not going to be achieved when the illiteracy rates are so high. You know, literacy is foundational.
Right now, the city, nonprofit groups, and private companies often have to run classes and programs to close the education gap. One of those companies is DTE Energy, the big local utility. We took the elevator to the 23rd floor to meet with Diane Antishin, Vice President of Human Resources Operations at DTE. A big part of her job is creating programs that help DTE build a workforce. That means internships for high school kids, including from some of the plaintiff schools, and sometimes extra training.
We're assessing the young people while they're here. We actually put them through a diagnostic assessment yesterday to understand their literacy and numeracy skills, because we want them to be able to continue on to the program that we've developed in partnership with a local college, and we want them to be ready for success when they land there.
Antishin says three big reasons that Detroiters don't get jobs at DTE are lack of basic literacy or ninth grade math skills, failed drug tests, and lack of transportation. For kids coming out of Detroit public schools, a little extra help from private industry can make a big difference. When we sat in the park with Jamarier Hall, I asked him about that skills gap and whether the kids in his class had trouble reading.
Probably most of them, to be honest. Like probably can't sit there and read a real 12th grade novel or something like that. I probably can't even, because my last couple of years, I don't think that my reading skills have advanced that much. It's not that they're dumb. It's just they haven't been taught the 9th through 12th grade necessities, and it probably goes back before that, too.
Hall is headed to community college in Florida this fall. He wants to be an accountant. I asked him if he was scared about the future, maybe going to college and not feeling prepared. He thought for a second and then said that after getting through Osborne, well,
I'm ready for anything. I'm not going to let anything stop me. Basically, I know I'm not going to go there and be the smartest in the class or know everything that the professor is talking about, but I know I'm smart enough to ask for help. I know I'm smart enough to use my resources.
For now, he's watching this lawsuit. And if plaintiffs win this case, it could change the way public schools all across the country look at literacy. I'm Lizzie O'Leary for Marketplace.
For more on the lawsuit and its implications, we've got Mike Griffith. He's school finance strategist at the Nonpartisan Education Commission of the States. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
The plaintiffs here are arguing that illiteracy is traceable to these schools, this school system. In response, the state points to other factors that contribute to illiteracy, including poverty, lack of parental involvement, medical problems, intellectual limitations. Does the state have a point here?
There is research that shows that it's more difficult to educate students who experience these sort of high poverty issues, including lack of regular food, lack of parental support. But just because it's harder doesn't mean that it's not achievable. There are districts around the country that have high poverty rates, that have low education achievement rates in their area, yet still are able to graduate their students, to get them up to state standards, and to definitely meet that lower benchmark of illiteracy. There is an argument out there that schools alone can't do this, that they need other supports, that a lot of the things that we hear from high poverty school districts is that we spend so much time supplying basic needs for these kids, so providing them with a safe environment, providing them with food, that they don't have enough resources to put into basic education. Usually when they're making this argument, it's to get kids up to state standards, which is a much higher level. Parents' involvement in education is extremely important. There's just no way that the school district can kind of influence that. They can help parents who want to try, but if a parent doesn't want to help their kids or is unable to help their kids, then there's nothing much the school district can do.
That brings me to my next question, which is how does Detroit compare to other cities, other states with sort of a similar demographic?
In all honesty, a lot of the larger urban districts are struggling. We would tend to think of comparing Detroit to Philadelphia, Chicago, Cleveland. Some, like Chicago, had some successes for years, but seem to, you know, be struggling a bit more now. They need all the educational resources that kids in suburban and rural districts get. But they also need what we tend to call wraparound services, which are all the other services that exist in schools. And they need additional funds for those. There's a lot of good research out there that shows once you get to more than half of your kids being low-income or at-risk kids, you need additional resources for those kids. Hmm. So what we would say is each individual at-risk kid needs additional resources to begin with. Then as you move beyond 50%, the cost per kid then goes up even higher. So Detroit struggles getting their kids to graduate and getting their kids up to state standards and then moving those kids on to either work or some sort of post-secondary education. It's been struggling with its finances. It's been struggling with how it educates its kids. The hope now is they've hit kind of a stable point or a little more stable than they've been in a while. Their hope is that they can use this stability to move forward. But what this lawsuit brings forth is this idea that all of these struggles have shown that they're having a difficulty getting their kids even at the lowest bar, which is simple literacy.
If the plaintiffs, as this case winds through the courts, and it sounds like there's a long and windy path in front of it, if the plaintiffs are successful at the end and they establish there is a constitutional right to literacy, what would the implications of that be?
So this ruling actually could impact schools around the country because this is being tried not in state court but in federal court. That would mean that it's not just Detroit school kids, but all kids around the country, theoretically, if this went all the way to the Supreme Court, that would have the right to literacy within their schools. Now, granted, that's a pretty low bar. The goal in most states isn't literacy. The goal is to get them up to state standards, which is significantly higher. But what it could mean is it could force states around the country to start putting more resources into high poverty areas that have a disproportionately high percentage of their kids that are not at full literacy. The courts have said in the past, education is not a federal right. It's not within the U.S. Constitution. That means that it devolves down to the states. So if you end up having this kind of move on to the courts, you have to ask yourself, what are the federal courts going to decide that's going to be different this time? Are they going to say that, well, maybe different parts of education aren't protected, but the basic right to literacy is? And that's something that's going to be up to the courts to decide.
Mike Griffith is school finance strategist at Education Commission of the States. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
You can read more about this case on our website. We're at marketplace.org.